Egypt goes to the polls today, Tuesday, January 14th. This is The World. Egyptians are voting on a draft constitution, their first time at the polls since the country's first freely elected president was ousted. Meanwhile, in a Syrian town, activists find the strength to kick out the jihadists.
One of the activists from Kafrenbel was telling me, which I loved, is that we have been living in a dictatorship for the last 50 years, and there's a little tyrant inside every one of us.
And later, thieves in London make off with a tiny and invaluable water lily.
Unlike stealing a painting, which gives you one painting, if you steal a rare flower, you have the potential to make lots of flowers and make lots of money.
Plus, Belgian-style Trappist beer made in New England.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. After 3 years of upheavals, Egypt is voting on a new constitution this week. The military-installed government is hoping the referendum will give it a popular mandate, something it's lacked since the army ousted the freely elected government of Mohamed Morsi last summer. Since then, Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood has been outlawed as a terrorist organization, and Morsi himself sits in jail. Voting in the referendum is taking place today and tomorrow. The Brotherhood is calling for a boycott. H.A. Hellier is a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. What does it feel like to be in Cairo today? I mean, we've been hearing streets plastered with posters calling on voters to say yes to the Constitution and no to terrorism.
That's pretty much the framing that has been pushed for the past few weeks. The vote isn't really on the Constitution in terms of the actual document. It's very much about other issues, stability, moving forward on the economy, support for the military, opposition to the Brotherhood, opposition to terrorism, you know. And incidentally, on the other side, it's the same thing. The Brotherhood isn't pretending that they're opposed to this constitution on the basis of its articles, but by the process itself, saying, no, we already have a constitution, we're not interested in this one. And participation in the referendum itself is recognizing the coup that led to the ouster of Mohamed Morsi, and that's not acceptable, hence we are not going to participate, let alone say no.
So what exactly is on the line for Egypt with this voting today and tomorrow?
It's the first chance for the military-backed interim government to actually say, look, we've called a vote as part of this roadmap. And look, we've gotten great turnout. We've gotten a yes vote. Nobody expects, incidentally, that it won't be a yes vote. But the turnout is very important. The better the turnout, then the better the result for the government.
So General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, he's clearly the most powerful person in Egypt today. What's at stake for him in this vote?
He came out very strongly a few days ago saying that, I mean, he implied this. He wasn't quite so blunt, but implied that if there were a good yes vote with good turnout, then he would regard that as a mandate for him to then run for the presidency. I think if he were to do that, then he would win.
Do you have a sense of which way the U.S. would like to see this vote go, aside from fair?
Well, aside from fair is very interesting because people usually talk about free and fair elections, right? So it is very likely that the next couple of days we will see free elections in the sense that there won't be widespread fraud and ballot box stuffing and things like that. I don't anticipate that, frankly. It could happen, but that's not what I'm thinking of. Fair is a totally different issue, and I doubt very much that anybody could consider this to be fair, considering how difficult it was to campaign for a no vote. I don't see the Obama administration having much of a preference in that regard. I think that their preferences have been overlooked and ignored, pretty much. So I think it is very difficult for people to imagine a situation where the American administration would be able to push this one way or the other.
A.J. Hellier is a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's been speaking with us from Cairo. I appreciate your thoughts. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In Syria, the battle among rebel groups continues. The more moderate groups are pushing back against the extremist factions that control many areas now. Today we zero in on Kafran Bel, a town known as the creative hub of Syria's revolution. The town's artists are famous for their bold posters and banners, often written in English, lampooning President Bashar al-Assad. But in recent months, the town's residents have taken to the streets to protest the ISIS, an extremist group that's also known as the Islamic State of Levant and Iraq. That's according to opposition activist Mariam Jalabi. She was born in Damascus and raised in the Golan Heights. Jalabi currently directs the New York office of the National Coalition of Syrian Revolution and Opposition Forces. She says the Kafran Bel residents have once again shown their creativity.
They used a lot of signage that was from the pop culture, global pop culture, referring to the ISIS, the Islamic State of Levant and Iraq, the fundamentalist group now that's raiding Syria, as an alien, as they had used it from the movie The Alien. Because a lot of the fighters that are coming with this group are not Syrians, they're foreigners.
So the ISIS, the fundamentalists,
yes.
They are presently being kind of earmarked as the big problem spot in Syria right now. So ISIS came in to Kafran Bel as well?
Yes, they did. They came in. They have taken the northern part, like they have mostly been in Raqqa, but they also arrived to Kafran Bel. And as the Kafran Bel activists have described it, is that they first were occupied by the regime forces, and then later on they were occupied by the ISIS forces, the fundamentalist groups. They came in December 28th and raided their offices, and that's why when the Kafran Bel people decided this cannot be tolerated and decided to get them out.
Right. So what exactly happened when ISIS comes into Kafran Bel? And you've got this kind of creative force of opposition. What happened?
They came in, they took equipment, they raided offices, they actually arrested people, they detained people. So the people of Kafran Bel, who have been working in close connection with a lot of other activists that are coming from all over Syria, who have found safe haven if Kafran Bel, realized that they cannot tolerate such forces, fundamentalist forces in the city. So they've actually created a pressure on the FSA in the outskirts.
Free Syrian
to
Army.
The
yeah.
Free Syrian Army to push the fundamentalists out. Then they were able to actually push them out.
So about 10 days ago, I gather, a kind of a power shift occurred. Is that essentially what happened then?
Yes. And now they consider Kafran Bel free again from the regime forces and the ISIS forces. So we have the two as working with the opposition and trying to promote all kinds of sorts of ideas of democratic free Syria for equal rights for everyone. We have a lot of problems. We have huge problems with not the regime only, but also with fundamentalist foreign groups that are coming into Syria that are trying to create a safe haven for them there. These rogue elements from all around the world, they come into Syria and they work there.
And this power shift, is that kind of a trend now? And can Kafran Bel kind of hold on to the ISIS forces staying out now?
They have been. They've actually not only that, but they've inspired other forces in the Free Syrian Army to go ahead and resist the fundamentalist group. And they've done that in Aleppo also. And they've done in parts of Raqqa. It has been back and forth a little bit in Raqqa, but they have been able to free something like 60% of the areas that they were holding on to.
It must have been really odd to have this kind of creative force, as you call it, of opposition people and their protests and their signs in English, and then these very hardline fighters coming in. And what was that like when they were all together in the same town?
It's very frustrating and it's very alienating for a lot of the Syrians because they are not Syrians. These foreign fighters that are coming in, they don't speak even the language. They're coming from places where they have different languages and they're coming in to do jihad, to create some kind of an Islamic state. And that's not what Syrians came out for. Syrians came out for a democratic civic society where everybody can have equal rights. So it has been very difficult for a lot of people to accept them. But also when they come in the name of God, and they're talking Islam, it becomes difficult for people also to resist them, or we don't know how to resist them. One of the activists from Kafran Bel was telling me, which I loved, is that we have been living in a dictatorship for the last 50 years, and there's a little tyrant inside every one of us. In order to get rid of that, that's when we can get rid of all of these tyrannies around us, the ideological tyrannies, whether it's the Assad or fundamentalist groups.
So, Mariam, what hope does the Kafran Bel story give you for the future of Syria?
it is very important for me to see people who are against all odds are able to create some kind of a civic society where everybody respects everybody else, which I hope that all women and all minorities within the Syrian revolution can have for the future.
Mariam Jalabi with the New York office of the National Coalition of Syrian Revolution and Opposition Forces. Thank you for coming into the studio. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
A tiny water lily, only the size of your fingertip, is missing. British police are investigating. The extremely rare plant was allegedly stolen last week from the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew in West London. The Nymphaea thermarum is no ordinary flower. It used to grow in southern Rwanda, but there are only a few plants left. The managers of Kew Gardens say they're still in the midst of the investigation and didn't want to compromise it. So who do we talk to about flower theft? Well, Susan Orlean, obviously, the author of The Orchid Thief. So just remind us first of the mania of the flower obsessives in your book. I mean, would you say it's mania or just a passion that goes further than most passions?
Well, it's the entire spectrum. There are people who are complete maniacs and have a passion for the rarest of the rare, and they will go to great extremes. Then there are also people who perhaps are a little more cynical and simply understand the economic value of having a rare plant the way any rare item has an actual value on the market. The remarkable thing is, unlike stealing a painting, which gives you one painting, if you steal a rare flower, you have the potential to make lots of flowers from it and make lots of money.
I like the art theft metaphor. It's kind of people who love beauty, but their moral compasses aren't calibrated very well, I guess.
Plus, in the case of stealing from Kew Garden, you know, you're talking about somebody who is willing to, say, lean over, take a little trowel, dig it up and hide it in a pocket and sneak out. It's plain theft with a darker side, which is if you're stealing something that's endangered, you could be ending its existence on Earth if you happen to kill this specimen.
How active is this world of flower theft?
You're going to be surprised when I tell you that it's quite active. It's an enormous industry. In the case of rare species that are difficult to grow, like this water lily or an orchid, you're talking about a more limited audience. But if you, say, steal a plant that you can then propagate and turn into a commercial venture, you're talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars.
But fencing a rare orchid or rare lily, it's going to be fairly obvious. I mean, what are they going to do with these flowers?
Nobody will ever be able to identify that this particular plant was the exact one that came out of Kew Garden. So you've got a problem in terms of prosecuting. You could say, well, I don't know, I was in Rwanda and I saw this cute flower and I took it. There's really no way to prove that it was the one stolen. But say you can then propagate it. And suddenly you have an exclusive market on a very pretty little plant. People will say, wow, I've never seen that before. I want that.
Do you think it's going to be easy to apprehend whoever stole this lily from Kew Gardens? I mean, profile the average thief for the London police for us.
If this is a person with a commercial goal and suddenly they're being propagated, you may be able to figure out who did it. If it's somebody who's just a crazy plant fanatic, it's lost forever. The people I met who were plant fanatics, you wouldn't recognize them walking down the street as a plant fanatic. They are rich, they are poor, they are scientists, they are housewives, and they're people who are just passionate, who love the exotic, and they'll go to great extremes to get it.
Susan Orlean, the author of The Orchid Thief. I don't know, maybe you'll be on the case of The Lily Thief. Anyway, thanks.
It's my next book.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
The Nymphaea thermarum is no ordinary flower. We've posted pictures of the tiny missing water lily at PRI.org. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here's an unusual restaurant review that also happens to be a geoquiz, freshly served up by one of our listeners out on the West Coast.
Hi there, I'm Alex from Oakland, California, and I listen to The World on KQED 88.5 San Francisco. Okay, I've got a quiz for you. And where would you find a North Korean restaurant called Pyongyang, known for its steel bowls, steel chopsticks, and long noodles served by waitresses who sing Celine Dion hits like My Heart Will Go On while they serve you dinner? I've been there. Okay, the answer is the Pyongyang restaurant is in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. I heard about the Pyongyang restaurant from some friends who I was staying with in Phnom Penh. The rumor at the time that I heard was that the North Korean embassy staff were just kind of bored with their jobs, and so they had started this restaurant. We got in about 7. The waitresses were all dressed in these black dresses with white collars. They had red and blue name tags in the shape of the North Korean flag. We ate some noodles and kimchi and rice and bibimbap and everything you would kind of expect to find in a North Korean restaurant, except that the bowls were steel and the chopsticks were also steel. We had these noodles, which must have been 3 feet long. It was a little tough to eat with the steel chopsticks, but it was doable. Or the height of the evening came when the head waitress sang My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. So that was pretty great. We all kind of laughed at that. So on the way out, you know, we all left in the group and we said goodbye, and the waitresses kind of waved us on and they said, thank you for coming. I'd love to see if there's a real Pyongyang restaurant in Pyongyang one day. And I'd love to see if they also sing Celine Dion at that restaurant as well, or if that's just for their franchises.
Thanks to listener Alex Park in San Francisco for his review of the Pyongyang restaurant, located in the answer to our geoquiz today, Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Tonight, by the way, our partners at Frontline have a new documentary about the secret state of North Korea. Yesterday, we interviewed director James Jones, and tomorrow you can talk to the filmmaker. Join our own Aaron Schachter as he moderates a live chat. That's tomorrow starting at 1 p.m. Eastern on PRI.org. Okay, now to another unexpected thing in an unexpected place. Belgian Trappist beer made anywhere but Belgium. There are not many of those monks in the world, so imagine our surprise when we learn that there's a Trappist brewery right in our own backyard.
I think the word you're looking for, actually, Marco, is delight.
That's The World's Clark Boyd, who joins me for our Sideways Glance, those stories that make us do a double take. So you man the Sideways Glance desk, Clark, and you live for several years in Belgium, the motherlode of Trappist beer. How big a surprise was this for you?
I had no idea that there were Trappist monks in America who were even interested in doing this sort of thing. There are a few Trappist monasteries outside of Belgium who have gotten the official designation. But to hear that this monastery in Spencer, Massachusetts was doing it, man, that's the definition of a double take for me. Unfortunately, Marco, my schedule wouldn't allow me to go out and do the reporting on this.
All right. So let's live vicariously with the world's Nina Porzuki.
When I first heard about beer being brewed by Trappist monks in the U.S., I thought, what's the big deal? Then I spoke with Kate Baker, the operations manager at Craft Beer Cellar in Belmont, Massachusetts.
It's not a designation that just gets handed out lightly. There's only 9 in the entire world and the entire universe.
There are actually 10. Another designated Trappist brewery just opened up in the Netherlands. And like the designation Champagne, a Trappist beer may only be called Trappist if it passes certain criteria. The brewery must be on monastery property, operated by Trappist monks, and revenue can only go to support the monastery. Until now, Trappist brewing has mostly been a Belgian thing. But this December, the Trappist monks of St. Joseph Abbey in Spencer, Massachusetts, rocked the beer world with the news that they had been designated the latest brewery to be recognized as Trappist. The monk behind the Spencer Brewery?
You're going to start bringing grain in shortly for tomorrow's brew?
Father Isaac.
Ah, there it goes.
He's a Trappist monk. And just as you imagine, long white robe, black hood, bald with glasses, he's even got this joyful little laugh. You'll see what I mean.
There's a little stress because you're really going to be evaluated. And the big question is, you know, really, a Trappist brewery outside of Europe, what are they going to do?
Cue the prayers. Trappist monks are self-sustaining. They farm, make, and sell cheese. There's even a monastery that makes lentil soup to support itself. The monks of St. Joseph's make jelly and vestments. But looking into the future, they saw that the upkeep for their monastery was going up. And jelly sales, well, they weren't going to cut it.
So how do we solve it? Do more jelly, but, you know, we're a niche player in a pretty tight market. Do more vestments, but the priest population in the U.S. has dropped dramatically. Generate some electrical power with turbines, but our primary site turned out to be on the flight path of the Worcester Airport. The FAA turned us down.
The FAA's loss is the beer world's gain. And so the story goes that one of the brothers, with a bit of a craft beer obsession...
As much as one can in the monastery, he kind of stayed plugged into that part of the world.
Convinced the others that beer just might be the answer.
We did some research to find out who would know the most about Trappist brewing among craft brewers.
When we received the email, when I got it, the first instinct is that someone was pulling, you know, my leg because... I am, you know, really interested in monastic brewing.
That's Dan Paquette, co-founder of Pretty Things Beer and Ale Project. He answered the email, and soon he found himself advising the monks on the long history of monastic brewing. Now, if alcohol and devout religious practice might seem like a funny combination, it's not, says Paquette.
Before tea and coffee, you had beer to drink. Beer is basically sanitized water.
Want to see the lab?
I would love to see the lab. That's what I'm...
Before they built the lab, they began experimenting with brewing in a room in the old dairy barn.
We burned the mash on the first brews, which means you couldn't drink them. You don't want to drink them.
And it took 24 test brews until they settled on the beer that they hoped to sell. It's a refectory ale, meaning a simple golden ale based on the beers that Belgian monks traditionally brewed, not to sell, but to drink themselves in the abbey.
There's a series of flavors as it moves across your tongue and you swallow it, but at the end, there's a really clean finish.
They built a brand new brewery on the abbey grounds that kind of looks like IKEA meets the Da Vinci Code. And in December, Father Isaac brought the beer to Belgium for final approval by the International Trappist Association.
I was encouraged when people started asking for refills. I said, I think we're going to be okay.
The beer is not being sold at the Abbey, and you can't visit, another International Trappist Association rule, but it's being distributed in Massachusetts. As for the rest of the world, as Father Isaac says, beer making in many ways is like the monastic life. You gotta have patience. For the world, I'm Nina Porzucchi, Spencer, Massachusetts.
You can see what the only official Trappist brewery in the U.S. looks like. Nina took some great pics at St. Joseph's Abbey, and you can meet the monk behind the Spencer Brewery. That's all at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, an American crime writer suddenly finds himself the center of attention in an unlikely place. Tokyo.
This was like movie star press, right? Like I walked out through the store and it was, you know, like hundreds of flash bulbs going off and TV cameras everywhere.
We'll hear why author David Gordon is big in Japan. That's up ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Seems shocking that just as more governments around the globe recognize same-sex marriage, Nigeria today enacted a new anti-gay law, the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act. It criminalizes gay marriage and gay organizations and anyone associated with them. Homosexuality was already illegal in Nigeria, but this new law goes further. Violators face jail sentences of up to 14 years, and those who advocate for gay rights or, for example, treat diseases like HIV and AIDS are vulnerable to arrest. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the law dangerously restricts the freedom of expression and association of all Nigerians. Davis Mack Ayala is a Nigerian gay rights activist who lives in London. He had to leave Nigeria several years ago and was granted political asylum in Britain.
The already existing law was inherited from our colonial masters.
And that would be Great Britain.
That's Great Britain, and it's kind of not, you know, very easy to prove. But the law that has just been passed now kind of criminalizes everybody and make everybody illegal, because in Nigeria, according to Nigerian constitution, marriage is defined as between a man and a woman. So which means that, you know, same-sex marriage is already illegal in Nigeria. I think that what they want is to have a way of further persecuting and punishing innocent LGBT people by the law. I can tell you as we speak that LGBT people in Nigeria are being witch hunted. The police are witch hunting people. Some homophobic people are taking the laws into their hands. Before this law, people are trading carefully when they deal with LGBT people. But now, they can violently attack LGBT people.
Are you hearing these reports from people you're in touch with back in Nigeria?
Yes, I'm hearing this report right from home in Nigeria.
What was the impetus for this bill, this Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act?
Basically, what they want to achieve is to fulfill the interests of Nigerian religious leaders. I heard the president in his comment in the bill saying, oh, he's doing this for what Nigerians want. But I think that's a big mistake, because if you know Nigeria, what Nigeria want is good road, electricity, you know, good education. Nigerians are living in poverty. Things are not working well. And every ordinary Nigerian wants a good life. I don't think Nigerians at this stage in time, this is the kind of gift that Nigeria wants.
Now, when you say religious, this is kind of an appeal to religious leaders. Are you thinking evangelical Christian leaders or Muslims or who?
Well, since 2006, when the idea of a bill was first introduced in the Nigerian parliament, the religious leaders, the Anglican Church of Nigeria, who are also connected to right-wing conservative Christians in America, have forcefully and strongly support the bill. And also Islamic leaders, where, you know, like in the northern Nigeria, where there are Sharia laws, you know, you have Muslim scholars and religious leaders strongly supporting this bill.
It's interesting that this law, though, is kind of similar to a new law in Uganda, which also criminalizes same-sex marriage and also stymies any activism because it criminalizes anyone working on gay rights. So what do you think the future looks like, in your opinion, in Nigeria?
Well, the future is very dark, you know, because those who provide services for LGBT people, especially in the area of HIV/AIDS treatment or counseling, definitely will be put at risk.
Davis, when you were living in Nigeria, you were the principal of a small Anglican elementary school, and you were fired in 2003. Why was that?
Well, once the issue of my sexuality, you know, has come to a public, the education board didn't want me again. They couldn't see all the qualities and skill that, you know, I have. And this is why this same bill that has been passed into law is worrisome, because LGBT people can be fired from work without them having the right to go and challenge such dismissal in court. I didn't have anywhere to take my case to. I was receiving all kinds of threats, not only from the church, but also from outside the church. That led to me having a physical attack. Luckily, I survived, which led me to, you know, go on exile. And from exile, you know, I have to come to the UK, you know, to be safe. So it's a very hostile situation in Nigeria for LGBT people.
Davis Mack Ayala is a gay rights activist from Nigeria who now lives in London. He's been telling us about Nigeria's new same-sex marriage prohibition act. Davis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here's a disturbing question for you. Is Al-Qaeda dead or alive? The line from the White House is that the terrorist group's leaders have mostly been routed from their caves in the mountains of Afghanistan, and the remnants have struggled to reorganize. But if you listen to the experts studying the recent fighting in Iraq and Syria, Al-Qaeda has resurfaced. So who's right? We turn to Fawaz Jajess, professor at the London School of Economics. He's written about Al-Qaeda and the Middle East extensively. He's also written a book called The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda. Fawaz, tell me, first of all, when we're talking about Al-Qaeda today, who exactly are we talking about?
I think this is a very good question. We're not talking about Al-Qaeda Central, Al-Qaeda of Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri. We're not talking about Al-Qaeda of the global jihad, which carried out the 9/11 attacks against America. Now we are talking about local Al-Qaeda-linked fighters who target the near enemy as opposed to the far enemy. The far enemy meaning the United States and its European allies. And it's essential for listeners worldwide to make a clear distinction between Al-Qaeda of the global jihad of Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden and the various Al-Qaeda groups, local groups, in Iraq, in Somalia, in Syria, who are targeting local rulers who basically oppress their population. So there's a major operational and conceptual distinction between the global movement of Al-Qaeda and the local factions and groups that have proliferated in the last few years in the Middle East and the Muslim world.
Well, if you read some of the reports coming out of Syria and Iraq, some of these so-called Al-Qaeda fighters are coming from abroad. So do they have to like ask permission from Zawahiri before going to a place like Syria and fighting under the name of Al-Qaeda?
No, I don't think so. Most of the fighters who are going to fight in Syria are motivated by the brutal images of killings and torture and massive use of force inside Syria. They are targeting the near enemy. Either the Assad regime or the Nouri al-Maliki government in Iraq or the various local governments. Their focus, their operational priorities are local Arab and Muslim rulers as opposed to America and its European allies. The question is, for all of us, is what will happen to these particular groups and local factions 1, 2, 3, 4 years from now? What kind of radicalization they will undergo. In particular, some individuals from European and Western countries who go and wage jihad in local contexts like in Syria and Iraq and Somalia and other places.
So
there's a real danger.
Your concern is that they go from kind of a local view to a world view of jihad.
Absolutely. This is the real fear, is that no one can tell you what happens once radicalization takes place. No one can tell you what will happen to the tens of thousands of fighters who are battling the near enemy in Syria, in Iraq, in Somalia, and Yemen. The same thing happened in Afghanistan and Pakistan in the 1980s and 1990s. The fight against the near enemy mutated into a global fight against the far enemy, meaning the United States and its European allies.
You know, some experts are pointing to Iraq and Syria today and say it's just a matter of time before Al-Qaeda resurfaces in Afghanistan and Pakistan. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think Al-Qaeda went away at all?
Al-Qaeda Central, Al-Qaeda of Osama bin Laden, no longer exists as an effective organization. It's gone. It's dead. It's a shadow of its former self. Most of its leadership, most of its lieutenants, the rank and file of Al-Qaeda Central is gone, is dead. What remains of Al-Qaeda Central is the ideology. And this is the ideology that has traveled near and far. It's not just a label, as some experts say. It's a very deeply entrenched ideology. Unfortunately, despite all the wars that the United States has waged over the last 13 years or so, the ideology remains intact, even though Al-Qaeda Central does no longer exist as an effective organization.
Fawaz Jajess, author and professor at the London School of Economics, thanks very much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
One of the great things about traveling abroad, you can be whoever you want to be. And locals will often take you at face value. Of course, that all changes the moment you duck back into your daily life back home. But when you're away, it's like you can be a different person. David Gordon had that experience, but at a level that's almost hard to comprehend. And David, you wrote a book a few years back called The Serialist. This is where we drop the phrase, but you won't believe what happened next. The book did okay here, but what did happen next?
It weirdly took off in Japan. I would sort of get word, oh, your book won a contest in Japan. It won another contest in Japan. It won a third contest in Japan. And then I found out that, in fact, I was the first person, apparently in history, to win all three of those contests.
Wow. So suddenly you're big in Japan. And you had no intention of writing this book, The Serialist, for consumption by a Japanese audience, right?
Oh, none whatsoever. I mean, it's a fairly, I would say, kind of highbrow literary thriller set completely in New York.
Give us a plot. I mean, tell us what it's about and why you think it actually appealed to Japanese.
The first part, I know the answer. The second part's a bit of a mystery to me, too. But basically, it's about a pulp writer, a guy who gets by writing multiple book series under multiple names, right? So he writes like a vampire series, a hardboiled detective series, softcore porn, sci-fi, anything, all under different names. And he's kind of eking out a living, hanging out in Queens, where he's from, and he gets a kind of once-in-a-lifetime offer where a famous serial killer on death row says to him, I'm a fan of yours. I want you to ghostwrite my memoir where I'm finally going to tell about the crimes I've committed before I'm executed. And so he goes and starts meeting with this serial killer upstate at Sing Sing Prison and ends up getting involved, of course, in yet another mystery.
Is there something in the meta kind of reference, you know, you write these chapters of this
yes,
fictional serial killer that appealed to Japanese, that attention to detail?
I think that I like these various kind of cult writers, science fiction writers, old gangster novels from the 70s, things from the 40s and 50s, and there's definitely an interest in that sort of stuff overseas.
Right. So, you're making history, winning a hat trick of awards in Japan, and then The Serialist gets made into a movie. Did you work at all on the screenplay?
No. I mean, again, it was really one of these out-of-nowhere things. So they were kind enough to invite me for the premiere, which, as the writer, you are not normally invited to walk down the red carpet at a Hollywood premiere, right?
Yeah, but you were.
But I was, yeah. So I showed up at the airport. My editor was there to meet me, but there was also a TV crew waiting to interview me, which, again, is not what normally happens when I hop on a plane in the U.S. You know, just the whole thing, taken to this very fancy hotel, picked up the next day and rushed off to the press junket. Like, I walked out into this room with the stars of the film. I mean, they weren't all there just for me, but I was with this cast and we stepped through this door and it was, you know, like hundreds of flash bulbs going off and TV cameras everywhere. I mean, I was very much like a deer in the headlights.
You must have felt different since you're being treated so differently.
It doesn't really feel real. It was so fast and over so quickly. I mean, you're talking about a couple of weeks or whatever. It felt too dreamlike. What I would say is that, look, I mean, I wanted to be a writer since second or third grade. I decided this is it. I'm going to be a writer. And really dedicated my life to it. And for a long time, nobody really cared at all. The big change for me was just selling a book, right? I mean, just to be a published author, just to be like working, all of that was fine. And I was very happy. But to suddenly weirdly have rooms full of people like applauding this thing that you've basically been doing on your own in a room by yourself for like the last 20 years, that was really intense.
This was like your own loss in translation moment. Have you felt a little let down since you've been home?
I wouldn't say like let down because, of course, my life here is very pleasant. But it is extremely strange. Even like coming here today, I was just, you know, here I am running in the rain, getting on the subway. You know what I mean? Like
rushing your own self to the room.
Yeah,
studio.
Yeah. Hoping to get a seat so I could like do some work because, you know, I have to teach a class later on this week or whatever. You know, like definitely not a superstar. Nobody knows that I'm actually the famous Japanese author. So,
David Gordon is the author of The Serialist. David, great to meet you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
David Gordon wrote about his experiences in the New York Times. You know what else is big in Japan? Suntory. And the Japanese beverage giant just got bigger after buying the American bourbon brands Jim Beam and Maker's Mark. The $16 billion deal makes Suntory the world's third largest maker of spirits, and it quenches Suntory's thirst for a larger market outside Japan, according to John McDooling with Quartz.
The U.S. is a huge consumer of alcoholic beverages, and it's the biggest market on the planet. And it just makes sense for a company that's stuck in a country where the population is aging, also shrinking, and it's hard to keep growing.
The deal goes beyond bourbon, by the way. Sauza Tequila and Courvoisier Cognac are now Suntory's as well. This is PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A cringe-worthy press conference today for French President François Hollande. It was his first formal Q&A with reporters since news surfaced of his alleged affair with an actress, and the first since his official partner and First Lady, Valérie Trierweiler, checked into a hospital with a case of extreme sadness. Hollande tried to stick to other topics like the economy and labor reform, but you just knew he was going to be asked about his love life sooner or later. Finally, one reporter asked whether, in the wake of the affair revelations, Ms. Trierweiler was still France's First Lady and whether she'll continue in that role when Hollande visits President Obama in February. Hollande did not answer directly.
Chacun, dans sa vie personnelle, peut traverser des épreuves.
Everyone in his private life can go through difficult periods. That is our case. These are painful moments for us. But I have one principle. Private matters should be dealt with privately in order to respect everyone concerned. So this is neither the place nor the time to address that question. But if I do not answer any question today on this matter, I will do so before the date that you mentioned.
Wow, what a cliffhanger. I guess the First Lady and the rest of us will just have to wait as well. The French normally don't get too worked up about a politician's sexual transgressions, but this whole presidential affair fiasco has struck a nerve with the public. While many are sympathetic with the spurned First Lady, others are more cynical, like this woman in Paris.
Pour moi, qui est la première dame, de toute façon, il faudrait purement et simplement supprimer le statut de première dame. On élit un président.
Rough translation, who cares who the First Lady is? We elect a president, she said, maybe even a woman president someday, but not a First Lady. Ooh la la, we definitely haven't heard the end of that story. Finally today, a story that takes us back to the Vietnam War. Back then, the communist leaders of North Vietnam weren't just concerned with how the war against the U.S. was going. They were also worried about what their citizens were singing. The North Vietnamese government only wanted songs that encouraged people to fight for the nation. Most other music was banned, especially love songs. That's how a young musician named Nguyen Van Lock ended up spending a decade in prison. Reporter Christopher Johnson visited the now 69-year-old artist at his cafe in Hanoi.
Nguyen Van Lộc still remembers the song that got him in trouble. When he was put on trial, Nguyen was accused of singing this classic as a statement against the government. But this isn't rebel music, Nguyen insists. It's not a call for revolution.
It's about love. It's about the last reunion between a man and a woman, before the man has to leave to go far away. It's about the last night they are together.
The song is from a style called Nhạc Trữ Tình, which means romantic music. The songs are usually about love and loss and broken hearts, kind of like the blues. As a young adult, Nguyen started a trio with two acoustic guitarists.
So, during our free time, we gather in a room and we close the door and we sang to one another. And only a few close friends who really love this music, we allow them to join us and listen to us.
They had good reason to keep their music a secret. This was the late 1960s. North Vietnam's war with U.S. and South Vietnamese forces was intensifying. The communist authority wanted its citizens' minds on victory, not the heartache of romance tunes. And there was another problem. The music was huge in South Vietnam. Songs like Suoi Mơ or Spring Stream filled Saigon's bars,
packed with cigarette smoke and American GIs looking for a good time. This music was like a soundtrack for the war effort. So the North officially outlawed most of it as the sound of the anti-communist enemy.
We knew that the state had banned the music, but we just didn't care. We had no political agenda.
Somehow the police found out about the group's clandestine concerts. For a month, they got called in for questioning. And in the spring of 1968, Nguyen headed down to the station on what he thought was another routine summons. He was 23 years old, a house painter who'd just fallen in love with a girl he met at one of the shows. He wouldn't see her again for 10 years.
I was arrested under the charges of suspicion of spreading the depraved culture of capitalism and destroying the culture of socialism.
The whole group was sent to prison. One bandmate got 15 years. When Van Loek did hard labor, serving out some of his time at the notorious Hanoi Hilton. Nguyen Thuy Ca is a music journalist and historian, as well as a composer. He fought in the war with the Red Army. Even as an artist today, he says the wartime ban was necessary.
Lost the war. That's what would have happened if we'd kept singing those gloomy, weak songs. Meanwhile, we're living under U.S. bombardment and air attacks. We would just be embracing one another and crying to die if we sang that music. We couldn't do that.
Today, Vietnam actually celebrates its old-school romantic music as part of the national heritage. This is like a slap in the face for Nguyen Van Loek. Both of his bandmates died in poverty after they got out. Over the last 3.5 decades, Nguyen has struggled a lot, too, mostly, he says, because of his criminal record. Nguyen's story isn't all about loss. The young woman he fell in love with before he was sentenced, they got married and had 2 kids before she died in 2002. He's also got this cafe that looks out onto the south side of Hanoi's biggest lake. He's dedicated the space to Vietnam's golden music. Nguyen and his band sing the classics for a well-dressed crowd, mostly older, but not entirely. Ding Van Tien is a 30-year-old engineer who's brought his girlfriend here for the first time. Most of their friends go for pop or rap, but Tien says he'll take Nguyen's cafe over a night at the club. This music is emotional, and it has deep feeling. Listening to Nhạc Trữ Thanh, Tien says, you're like a foreigner. You come here, and through the music, you can learn about Hanoi and Vietnam, and about the blues. For The World, I'm Christopher Johnson in Hanoi.
That's our program today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can be with us again tomorrow.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.